Welcome to Eric's Perspective. Joining me today at M. Hanks Gallery is Terry McMillan. Terry, thank you for coming.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
I really appreciate you being here. I just thought maybe we could start off by talking a little bit about how you got started as a writer.
Oh, as a writer? This I know I can talk about. I think I started writing poetry, bad poetry. Technically, my first job was at a library. I was 14 and in Michigan, and I was a page. And that's how I started reading. We didn't, the only books we had in our house was the Bible. And I really used to sneak and hide in the dumbwaiter and the bathroom and put my feet up, and I would just read. And I didn't realize at first. Oh, and I found in this house that we lived in, I found Bartlett's Book of Quotations. Uh-huh. One of the, I wish I still had it. But it was in between the slats of our floor. And I just started reading. I didn't know you people had all these thoughts. Uh-huh. You know, because it's an alphabetical order, you know. Anguish, anger, law, love. I mean, but everything. And I mean, I was like, I mean, I didn't talk to people who talked about this stuff. Except at Sunday school, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing I know, I don't know, I wrote a poem. I guess it was a poem. I pushed it all to the left.
Do you still have it?
Maybe. I don't really know. I have a lot of stuff in storage. And I just told my son, you know, when I'm dead, just go get it. It's in a special place. But I ended up going to UC Berkeley, majoring in journalism, because I actually started just writing. I wrote for Berkeley's campus newspaper. We had two of them.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it was not that big of a deal to me. I didn't think of it as real writing. Uh-huh. I was a college student, you know. And then the next thing I know, some guy broke my heart and I wrote a poem. He really pissed me off. And can I say that?
Yes, you can.
And then somebody read it and said, hey. But I ended up majoring in journalism. And then I found out that you could lie and still tell the truth.
How do you mean?
Well, I used to make up things that were about real human emotions. And I would just, I found out that I mean, I used to read a lot of fiction as well.
Yeah.
And I found out, you know, I could just make this stuff up. But if it was plausible, if it was believable, that could make it true. Because they were about, you know, about fear, love, anguish, poise, grace, laughter, hatred, you know, whatever. And I would just create these characters that had these feelings. And but they were feelings that I may very well have been feeling at the time, because I wrote about heartache and, you know, I was like 19. I don't even know if I'd had sex yet. And I'm talking about my heart is broken. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's how it sort of started. And you know, but to be honest, when I was an undergrad I was in journalism. And, you know, I didn't like journalistic writing because you had to tell the truth. And I had really started to get used to lying. And I used to have to go and, you know, review a play or whatever. And then I really did start lying.
You were writing about the play?
For in journalism, yeah. I would read something in the paper and then I would just siphon some things. And I would just make stuff up. I got good grades in journalism.
I was going to ask you, what was the
reaction? And that's how I found out that I could really lie and people would believe it.
Well, what you're calling lying sounds almost like just your imagination. You were like opening up.
Well, I'm still making it up.
Yeah.
It's not true.
Right.
But the idea is that emotionally, psychologically, or whatever, it was true.
Yeah.
And that's what fiction is.
Yeah.
That's what storytelling is. Otherwise, it's nonfiction. And I found that telling the real truth was kind of boring. Because you could stretch it when you lie.
Yeah.
I guess.
So how did you make the transition then from writing basically as a reporter?
Oh, I was not a real reporter. I only did that in my junior year.
Well, okay. So,
and then I just really started lying.
Just exclusively fiction?
I wrote poetry too, really bad poetry. Bad poetry.
Why do you call it bad?
It was bad. I know it was bad.
Oh.
It was bad. They were just sentences I pushed to the left. On the page. Yeah, some of them later on it turned out to be readable. But, you know, I learned that I could, because I read in my Spanish class that I failed. I had to read, I could speak Spanish back then. And I had to read Gabriel Garcia Marquez, 100 Years of Solitude in Spanish. And my instructor loved my voice, so I got to read it in class and all that. Now I couldn't tell you a word hardly. But I just found out how liberating it was to be able to tell a story that was bigger than my experiences. And because I used to always wonder why people did what they did, why they said what they said, mm-hmm. and why people hurt each other and break each other's heart, and, you know, why people were mean, why people lie. I just wanted to know what makes people do this.
Mm-hmm.
What makes you hurt somebody intentionally? I just didn't understand the motivation, to be honest with you. And to some extent, to this day, I still don't. But I try to jump out of my own skin into theirs. And sometimes it wasn't successful because I just, you know. I mean, I have a sister right now who is really mad at me for something that happened 30 years ago.
Not able to let go.
She just told me this yesterday. I couldn't even believe it. Couldn't even believe it. And I was like.
So until yesterday, you weren't even aware that this existed. Wow.
But I won't write about this.
Well, it sounds like it's been pent up for a long time. Lord. That could be pretty explosive.
I couldn't even believe it. But it's okay. But it doesn't mean that I wouldn't give what happened emotionally to another character, but it would be a completely different situation because I was really, first of all, I was insulted, and it was just very mean-spirited. I had another sister who was there who couldn't even believe she was saying what she said, and I was like, wow, doesn't even sound like she likes me.
Wow.
And I'm saying to myself, how many people have this in their families? You know,
yeah.
Where you don't like your sister or your brother.
Well, and then hold it in, too. I mean,
30 years.
Right.
Whoa. Yeah. But we can skip that subject.
Okay. We'll move on.
She'll never hear or see this, though, I can tell you.
She's not into the podcast world or anything like that.
She can't even. She's never been on Facebook, which I don't like. But Twitter is like, what a waste to her. Right now, I don't know if I could live without Twitter. I can say anything I want to say and vent. But anyway, so that's how I started writing.
So I saw something about your first book that you weren't happy with the way the publisher was promoting it. And so you actually actively went out and promoted it yourself, really. Is that true?
Yes.
And I was just curious. I was admiring the initiative and the energy.
Well,
to make that happen.
I had learned. I mean, I could always type really fast, and so I was living in New York. I was a grad student. I went to Columbia. I don't know how I ended up in film, but I've never made a film.
Hmm.
But it was screenwriting,
uh-huh.
The track, and. I ended up writing a novel called Mama, and it was, to some extent, it was semi-autobiographical, but almost everybody's first novel is, at least back in the day. And long and short of it is, I used to read about all these writers, and it was a bunch of students, and they called themselves a literary brat pack. And they were all white, all of them. And two of them I went to Berkeley with.
Mm-hmm.
all of them, when their books came out, they were all going on book tours. Wow. So I thought when mine was coming out that I was going on one too. And they said, oh no, we don't have the funds for you to go on a book tour.
Oh no.
And I said to my publisher, I said, what are you talking about? We don't have the money. I said, why not? All these other white kids went on book tours all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference? Well, we just didn't put it in the budget. I said, okay.
Oh, wow. So do you think it was racially motivated? It sounds like it.
Of course it was.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't even know. It was almost as if, well, we don't know if any black people are even going to read this book.
Ah.
You
so
know?
They didn't think it was much of an audience for it.
Yeah,
they were
bottom line, and which in and of itself was racist. I was thinking, and I even told her.
Yeah.
I really pissed her off, as a matter of fact. She said on my next book. Well, she said this after I sold out of my first printing.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And back, it was 7,500 copies. This was unheard of back then.
Yeah.
But I ended up, because I was doing word processing.
Uh-huh.
That's how I was paying my bills. And I found out there was some book out that told you how you could go about letting people know that you have a book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did. And because I had access to word processing and I worked at a freelancer at a law firm, which a very famous attorney, African-American attorney, worked at. And everybody in the word processing department were like, we didn't make any, you know.
So what, they were, you and others in the word processing department were responsible for typing up whatever these lawyers would want you to type up?
Yeah. But the woman who was the manager was also black, and she knew that I was writing.
Oh,
I had been writing, and so when I found out, I went to the back of the dictionary, and got the name of every black university. I did a lot of work, mm-hmm. but they let me type it.
Type your own stuff, basically.
And print it all out.
Oh wow!
And it was a lot of black young men in the mailroom, so they snuck and put the stamps on my letters. And I mean, I had the hookup, okay?
That's great.
And then before my book was published, and I wrote a letter. I wrote a letter to the president of Barnes & Noble. It was in Minnesota or somewhere. And my letter was polite. I didn't say anything about because I'm black, they're not hooking me up. I didn't.
Right. You didn't go there.
No.
Yeah.
But I just said, you know, a book is sort of like toothpaste. If you don't know about it, how can you buy it?
Right.
So, you know, this is my first novel. And, you know, my publisher is not willing to support it. And so I wanted to know, I sent him a little sample chapter.
Oh, did he, what was his
Yeah,
response?
They called my publisher and said, hey, why aren't you guys sending this girl on a book tour?
Oh, wow.
But I sent it to a lot of places.
Yeah.
And I got all the black bookstores at the time. We had quite a few all over the United States. I sent it to them. They ordered the book. So by the time my book was coming out, because I embarrassed my publisher.
Yeah.
I had sold out of my first printing, which was 7,500. That was a lot of books. They thought that's all I was going to sell if I sold those.
Right.
So they had to go back to a second printing and then a third printing. And then they were like, They were embarrassed,
yeah.
As well they should have been.
I was going to say they should have been.
You know?
Right.
And that's how it happened.
Wow, that's really incredible. I admired that whole the whole story behind that.
The thing is that you have to understand that I had seen so many other writers, white writers, whose work I loved.
Because
I wasn't discriminating.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And there weren't that many of us out here. I mean, Toni Morrison was already published. Alice Walker. There weren't very many.
By the way, do you happen to know whether they had a similar experience? I was just curious.
You know, I don't know.
No.
I don't know. See, Toni was working at, I think she was already working at Knopf. She didn't really have to do much. But her writing was a little different than mine.
Yeah,
you know, but.
Right.
And Alice Walker also used to write poetry. But you know, for the most part, a lot of us, and I wasn't the only one, but a lot of us didn't have that kind of respect. It wasn't there. They didn't know what our readership would be like, so they didn't want to spend any money.
Yeah.
And then after that, Disappearing Acts came out, and then they changed their tune.
So the same publisher as the first one. So you used the same publisher for the second book?
Yeah, but it was a different, because they changed their tune.
Okay.
The first two books.
Now they were more
interested.
Then
I left after that.
Yeah, because I would imagine, did you have any lingering feelings after that first experience? You basically dragged them in kicking and screaming, and now they finally get behind you.
I think it might have been my second book. Maybe that was the only one they did publish, and then I went to Viking.
Oh, okay. And how was your experience with them?
Great. I'm still with Viking, technically. Okay. Technically. Ballantine is the subsidiary of Viking.
Oh, okay.
They're all one big house. They just have different imprints.
Okay.
And I've been with them forever. And I've been on many a book tour.
No more problems with the book.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like I said, I was on a book tour when I was in Rome when my mom passed.
Yeah.
And that was my second book. That was Disappearing Acts. And I couldn't even believe it.
Yeah.
I could not believe it. But times change.
So, Terry, how many books total have you come out?
You know, they're not like children. You know, you can count them. I think it's 11 or 12.
Oh, okay. And we should say you've got a book coming out soon. I mean, is it okay it's okay to put that out there?
Next month. Yes, it's called It's Not All Downhill From Here.
Excellent. Well, we can.
And I'm going on an 18 city book tour.
All in the U.S. or any outside of the States?
These are just in the United States. Okay. That's all you can do because some of the other places, they don't publish them until much later.
I see.
Except for English speaking. I might go to London. I don't know, but I'm going over there anyway. I'm book or no book. I'm overdue.
Well, congratulations, by the way.
Thank you for
the new book, and we wish you much success with that.
Thank you.
So going backwards again, though, how did it come about? I can't remember whether it was Waiting to Exhale or Stella Got His Groove Back. That was the first one. Was Waiting to Exhale before as a movie?
Mm-hmm.
Do I have that order right? Mm-hmm. How did that happen? And were you involved? Because you mentioned before you had some screenwriting ability. Were you involved at all with the screenwriting part of it? Or how did that happen?
Oh,
and were you happy with it?
I had a good friend. She's still a good friend. Amy Tan.
Uh-huh.
Had written a Joy Luck Club. We met because our books were almost out at the same time. I think my first book had come out, Mama, and then I wrote Disappearing Acts. But the bottom line is that she told me, I think it was Waiting to Exhale. It was Waiting to Exhale. That was my third book. And she said, Terry, you got to talk to this guy, Ron Bass, because he helped me write, I just blanked. Amy Tan's first book, Joy Luck Club.
Yeah.
And so that's how I met Ron. But somebody had bought the movie rights, and I told them they wanted me to write the screenplay. I said, I don't know how to write a screenplay. And so that's what Amy said, Terry, talk to Ron, because I didn't know either.
Oh, so he's a screenwriter, basically.
Oh, yeah. He wrote Rain Man.
Oh, wow.
A few others, but that's the most famous.
Okay.
It was not a great experience. I didn't like it.
What was it that you didn't like about it?
Because it's you have to cheat. Hmm. You have to cheat. It's not fun. It's not fun. And you're sifting things from the book, including adding things that weren't in the book. It's not fun. I did it twice, and I shouldn't. I was asked to do it for my last book, which is called, what's the name of it? I Almost Forgot About You. And I tried it again after all these years, and I just finally said to Universal, I can't do this.
Huh.
It's not fun. And, I told it the way I wanted to tell it.
Right.
If somebody else wants to make a movie, knock yourself out. But I can't do this. And I told them, I said, you guys, but they let me keep the money.
That's the best part.
I mean, there's still another, they got another writer because I couldn't do it. And Viola Davis is starring in it and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, I'm out. I don't even care about the money.
Yeah.
But now they're almost finished, and so I'm going to go back and work with this other writer. They just want to make sure that it's called a polish, right?
Okay.
That it's the voice, because some of the script is still going to be used.
So wait, there's another one of your books being made into a movie? Is
that Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. What was the question?
Yeah. Well, no, we were talking about Waiting to Exhale and then Stella got her groove back.
Yeah.
And then you were talking about, because, you know, it's funny. I've read many different authors having an issue, with the transfer of it from a book to a movie.
Oh.
Because, you know, a lot of times, like you said, things are put in that weren't in the book.
But
some things are taken out.
What they're supposed to be.
Yeah. And I remember reading that, you know, George Orwell, for example, he didn't want his movie 1984. His book made it to a movie, but it was somebody that agreed to do everything according to the way he wished. And, you know, it's always a problem, it seems like. But it sounded like in this case, it was more of a personality clash between you and the screenwriter. Would that be safe to say? Or was it other things too?
That was
artistic.
That was both artistically and his vision about, you know, it was overkill.
Uh-huh.
And I don't write screenplays, and I know how to write a novel, but I don't know what you leave in and what you take out.
Right.
I don't know how to make those kind of choices. And that's why, you know, after the second draft, I mean, it took forever, but it was him.
Mm.
Very anal.
I see.
It's like everything had to be done a certain way. Then we had to do it this way. And I was like, you know, I'm an anti-authoritarian. I don't like people telling me what to do.
Right.
And writing a novel, nobody's looking over my shoulder.
No, you have.
You know what I mean? The bottom line is this. There's a difference between having an editor and they said, Terry, do you think this is clear? Are you sure you can't? Would it be okay if?
Right, right. The approach is totally different.
You know, and the bottom line is you can say, no, I like it just the way it is. But the bottom line is editors are really smart, especially if they really care about what the story that you're telling and the characters.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's a word, you know, or they want more.
Yeah.
I think you could go a little further. That's a whole different ballgame. You know, it's not fun.
Oh, I can
see. Will never do it again.
Oh.
And it might be happening soon. I'm not interested. They can have their money. It's like you fall in love with somebody, you break up, and then they want you back, and,
right.
And it can't be the way it was.
Right.
That might not be a good analogy, but the bottom line is that, you know, I wrote it the way I wanted it to be read.
Right.
Now, if you guys want to put faces and put it on the screen, knock yourself out. But no, I don't want to do it. They can have their money. It's a pain in the ass.
Hmm.
Whoops, pain in the butt.
No, it's okay. No, I get it. I totally.
But
get
I
it.
love. I mean, when we did Waiting to Exhale, you have to go around. They fly you everywhere, and I was with Whitney, of course, and
yeah,
we'd go do these screenings because they test the screenings, and Whitney, she was so loud. She'd say,
"You mean just sitting there and talking?"
No, she's sitting there talking to the camera,
right.
To the screen,
right.
Just like most black folks do. You know, she was.
Oh, you mean while watching the movie?
Yeah, watching the movie. The audience isn't even supposed to know we're there.
Right.
You know, they sneak us in the back and all this. And Whitney's like, "Jump in the pool, girl. Jump in the pool." And I'm like, and plus her voice was so distinct.
Of course, she's got that powerful
and
voice.
Says, oh.
And there's Whitney.
And Whitney's like, "Hey." And I'm like, you know what? That it was fun.
Right.
You know, we did it quite a few different places, but
yeah.
But that part of it is fun.
Yeah.
But not the writing and even the filming. You talk about boring.
Well, see, that's what a lot of folks I don't think realize. That making a movie or even a television show
is boring.
All the takes.
And because even Forrest when they were doing Waiting to Exhale, right?
Yeah.
Let me I'm not kidding you. He wanted me. He said, Terry, they wanted me to do a little cameo.
Oh.
And I said, first of all, I can't open my mouth. I can tell you that right now. Okay. This was in Phoenix, Arizona. It was like 100 degrees. And they had this girl, and this scene is in the movie. This girl playing this guitar at this fountain.
Uh-huh.
And it was some kind of, not country, what do you call it? Folksy,
okay.
Folk song.
Okay.
They wanted me to sit down and have lunch, like pretend like I was eating. And I said, nope, I don't want to do all that because I said, I don't know if I might have to floss or whatever. But I said, no. So then they said, well, Terry, Forrest said, would you just walk past her in the fountain? By about the 15th time of walking past this girl, I was ready. I said, you know, if you don't put that fucking guitar down, I'm going to push you in this pool.
So they did 15 takes of that scene.
It was more than that.
Probably more than that.
I was more than that. And she just kept singing the same thing. And I was thinking, how could she do this? And finally I said, when they said cut, and I said, Forrest.
No more.
I don't want to be in this movie. I don't want to do this. Because I cannot walk. One more time, I'm going to push her in that fountain.
So did that scene survive?
No. No. It was stupid. Didn't make any sense. I don't know.
So they were just trying to figure out a way to put you in the movie.
Yeah, they wanted me to do a cameo. And I was like, I'm not an actress. I'm a writer.
Yeah.
And who cares? I don't want to see myself on film anyway.
Was that the main reason you didn't really want to do it? You just wanted to always be in the background, not really.
Yeah,
out
I don't
there.
Want to be in a. I don't want to be in a movie.
Right. That's why we have actors, right?
Yeah. Plus, they had to put makeup on. That's all they do. They just have to come and do this over and over. I said, you know what? I'm not an actress.
I would imagine out there in Arizona too.
It was 101. I will never forget it. It was hot.
They must have had to do that a lot.
Oh, and then these people that do this for a living, I don't know how they do it. It is not fun.
No, you're right.
It's not fun.
That's the thing. A lot of folks may not realize.
And Lord only knows what would have happened if I had to say a line.
So how come you didn't want to say a line? I was just curious.
I wrote a book.
Right, you spoke through the
book. I wrote a book. I'm not an actress. I don't want to be a movie star. I don't need to be on film.
Yeah.
I didn't need all that.
Right.
You know, and I was flattered that they wanted to make it into a movie.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is I don't want to be in it.
Right.
You know, I'm not in the book.
Right.
You know, some stuff is overrated.
Yeah.
Hollywood is, you might want to take that out because I'm waiting for a check now.
I don't want to undermine your income ability. That's for sure.
But I feel very, very fortunate. There's no doubt about that. I mean, I've been very lucky. And, you know, everybody, when I've written a book, the next question, is it going to be a movie? No. You know?
Right.
No. I mean, how am I supposed to know? But the bottom line is this, if they want to buy the rights, of course you let them buy the rights. There's so many books that the rights have been sold, and they never become a movie.
Never make a movie, yeah.
You know, but the bottom line is you don't have to give that money back. Right. That's the part I like.
Right. It's a done deal.
Yeah.
So how I was just trying to remember, how much time went by between Waiting to Exhale as a movie and Stella Got Her Groove Back as a movie? Was it a long time in between? I forgot now.
That makes two of us.
I don't remember.
It was a few years.
Oh, okay. And what I was think. That? Was that a similar experience?
That was more fun because I got to go to Jamaica.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And Whoopi was funny. That one was, I didn't do any cameos in that one. I told them no cameos.
Right. Mm-mm. Right. And did you have a similar conflict when it came to screenwriting thing? No. Okay. That was a better experience.
That was much better. But I think I did write that one with Ron. I guess. I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. Who knows? I'm telling you, one day you'll be old.
I already
am. Some stuff that's on a shelf, and it can stay there.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And people have asked me questions like this, and I'm like, let me go back that far and think.
Yeah, right.
You know? I remember. It's a lot of things that I remember, but some things, they just don't stay there. And I've learned I don't even push it. I don't wreck my brain trying to remember a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
But I hope somebody buys the movie rights to this one because it's about older women. My new book is not all downhill from here.
Oh, okay.
And I think that older women deserve. I think we could use a movie, not necessarily mine.
Right.
But
focusing on the issues.
Yeah. And it's about aging. But my books always have humor mm-hmm. in them. Always. And this one I really, really like. Because the main character's husband on her birthday passes away. Oh. And she's got diabetes and all that, but she's got this group of friends. And she owns a beauty supply. And the story is about what happens with these women, especially after her husband passes away. And it's funny. I got a lot of, there's always humor in my books.
Yeah.
Because you can be depressed all by yourself. I don't need to depress you.
Right, right.
And it's one of them, I like this one probably more than all of them.
Oh, wow.
Maybe because I'm old. Because my hair is gray. At least a lot of it is. Thank God for red rinse. But it's stuff I do forget a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Like a word I'm thinking, what's that word? And then I just said, so many people I know, I just said, who cares? If it doesn't come to me, I don't care.
Right. Right.
Because I remember a whole lot of other stuff.
Yeah.
Besides this one word, I'm not going to like freak out about it.
Well, plus, does this happen to you? It happens to me where I can't think of it, but then sometime later on down the line, it pops in there.
Oh yeah. Oh Lord, yes. But everybody I know, and people that are younger than I am, go through the same thing.
Oh yeah.
You know, and I think part of it also, I really have come to the conclusion that it's not just age. I think it's we just have too much on our minds.
Well, I agree with you. I've read where it's also stress related, which is connected to
it's
too
like,
many things.
You know, I mean, you're on Twitter, you're on Facebook, you Instagram. I don't do Instagram. But it's like, you know, everybody wants everything right now.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why?
Yeah,
what's the rush?
Right.
You know, and that's even my publisher. They were like, well, Terry, is it possible we can? And I said, you know what?
Oh, you mean they were trying to push you to get?
Well, but the thing is this, they have their publication dates and all that. And, you know, that's why sometimes I just keep my mouth shut. And I, you know, like right now I have about 150 pages of a book. All I needed was 60. And I've just sent them almost 150.
You mean for yet another book, not the one that's coming out?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Because they start.
It comes out, right?
No, they start wanting to know how long do you think it's going to take you to finish it.
Oh.
And I'm like, you know, it's not a baby.
Right.
You know, that's 9 months. I don't know.
Right. You just have to respond to your own.
Yeah. And the beauty,
creative impulses.
The beauty of writing a book is writing the book, is telling the story.
Right.
You know, I don't know how it's going to end. You know, I don't know how it's going to end. And if I knew it, I wouldn't waste my energy. It's like getting married and you're already thinking about your divorce.
Right, right. And it kind of becomes contrived at that point. And if you already know the ending.
Thank you.
Right.
Yeah. Right. I mean, because it's a wonderful process for me and us as a writer.
Yeah.
And
the things you're saying about writing are, I my business is art and visual arts, and artists say the same thing. They don't know what they're going to, sometimes they get to the front of the canvas, they're not exactly sure how it's going to end up. If they did,
that's the beauty of it.
It's almost like a discovery. And sometimes they could put it on the canvas and, you know, not even realize some of the things they actually put on the canvas.
Thank you.
And I imagine it's the same thing for you as a writer or any other writer who's really,
you know, I have like thrown pens across the room and kicked a trash can, cried, laughed my brains out. And it's not because I think I'm funny. It's what my characters do or say that cracks me up.
Yeah.
Or makes me cry. And, you know, that means that you know, you just have to let it go. And take what these characters are thinking and feeling seriously.
Yeah.
And that's what I do. It's like it gives me a chance to jump out of my own skin and my own head and live inside someone else's heart and their head.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful. And I think over a period of time, at least I think, I don't know, It makes me a little bit more empathetic.
Well, I can see that because you're experiencing what that character's experiencing. You actually have to get in touch with whatever the emotions are behind their actions or their words or whatever in order to understand it, I would imagine.
Well, the other thing is that you write about people that you don't necessarily know. Because I'm not putting my family and all their business. But I write about people that I don't understand that I would like to understand. And the only way to do that is to jump out of my own skin.
Right. And try to put yourself in their place.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And also sometimes, you know, there are a lot of stupid things I do that, you know, I have character defects. They're free. I can give them to my characters, you know. And somebody said, Terry, do you know anybody like that? No. Mm-mm. I don't know why that bitch did that.
Where in the world did that come from?
I don't know. But it's a bit, I mean, I know I'm very, very fortunate. I know I'm lucky. And just right before I came here, because I'm doing my little website that's being updated, and I did a list of about 70 writers. I have writers worth reading. And a lot of them are, and they're all ethnicities, but they're writers, some of whom you might not know their work. Sometimes it's their first book. And, you know, I'm a little popular. And I have quite a few followers on Twitter, especially for a writer. I have like 261,000.
Oh, wow.
That's a lot for a writer.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially a novelist. And my thing is this, share the wealth.
Yeah.
They go click on there, and it's like a lot of people, they don't know who these writers are. And a lot of them are really good, really good writers. So my thing is this, if I put them on my website, and I say, look, here's some writers worth reading. And then I have a lot of books. I just did this before I came here. Books about writing, on writing, craft, and all that. So they can learn. Because it's a process, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, and to me, that's what this is partially about. You know, there are a lot of writers who still don't get more than 75. They might get 10,000 or whatever. But there are some writers who... which I find sad, first books, they are now, I just saw my old editor just bought this first novel. It's like 7 figures. Wow. Yeah. And I feel sorry for that writer, to be honest with you.
Why do you say that?
Because it's like, where do you go from here?
Oh, right, right. The bar is up pretty high.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, and it happens to a lot of writers now. That they get these really big advances, and then sometimes the book doesn't sell,
right?
Or the second book takes forever, and it's not. They're comparing it to the first one. Like I said, they're not children,
right?
You know, and it's really sad. And a lot of these writers are good writers, and you know, we're not competitors. You know, if I read your book, you can still read somebody else's. I can still read somebody else's book, you know?
Oh, yeah, sure.
And you might not even like my book. It's okay.
Right.
It's okay. But I believe that because there's some really good writers out here who more people need to know about their books. So.
Is there anybody in particular you
oh, I can't
call Can't call it to mind, no.
Well, yeah, I could, but no. I won't.
Okay. No problem.
Well, because there's too many of them, and if I name a few...
You'd be leaving somebody out.
Yeah, and I just... I mean, let me tell you. And there's some that I put on the list today that this morning, right before I left, I said... Because I'm looking at my book. I even put my bookcase, my bookshelves, on Twitter. And I made it so that you could see. And a friend of mine... One of my BFFs from college, from Berkeley, her daughter is the president of the National Book Foundation. You know, the National Book Awards every year they have. And she is only 40. Brilliant. Oh, wow. Brilliant, brilliant.
Impressive.
She calls me Auntie Terry. She says, well, she's been to my loft over here. And she said, though, Auntie Terry, what a collection, because she knows books. And a lot of people, because of the tone of my work and there's a lot of humor in my work and all that, they are shocked, people, when they come to my apartment. mm-hmm. loft, whatever you want to call it, and see the books that I own, the books that I read. Some of them I haven't read,
mm-hmm.
but to me, that's what a library is for. If I've read everything in it, what's the point?
Right.
You know?
Right. It gives you...
Yeah, so sometimes I just look and say, you've been in my place. You saw those books.
I did.
And I just think, oh. Because, you know, one day when I'm really old, that might be all I have to do is read. So I'll have them with me.
Well, there's something else somebody would see if they went into your loft, and that is your wonderful art collection.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that always... heartens me to have an artist whose voice is in one medium appreciating the art that's created by an artist that's in a different medium. That's really interesting. But you have quite a collection. Can you talk about how you got started collecting visual art?
When I was a student at Berkeley, I had this little apartment, and I bought these posters, really nice posters, and they were framed off Telegraph Avenue because it was like, you know, and it, you got to have something on your wall.
Right.
And I put these posts, they were framed posters, you know,
mm-hmm.
And it just made the room. Because it was a big studio apartment. Unlike, you couldn't find one like this now. This is up in the Oakland Hills.
Uh-huh.
And people would come in and say, where'd you get that? And it was like $14.99 or whatever. But the bottom line is, and I think the frame came with it.
Oh, excellent.
But the bottom line is that, and I used to sew and all that, so I make like my own duvet kind of thing. And it was like, it just added something to the room. And I had in every room. Every room. And I didn't, you know, it just... I didn't have a choice. You know what I mean? It was like...
You were just motivated internally to make sure he had something that was on the wall.
Well...
And it wasn't just... It doesn't sound like it was just decoration either. It sounds more like...
Oh, no.
Some like a spiritual aspect of it.
Some of these posters were basically knockoffs or prints or whatever you call it. Mm-hmm. What they called them then, I don't know. But they were beautiful.
Yeah.
And no African-American artist... Not back then, mm-hmm. that I wasn't even aware of. But I wasn't thinking of it as, it made me feel good when I walked into my gigantic studio apartment with my big water bed in the middle of the room. but I had a view. It was in the Oakland Hills, and the view, I could see San Francisco. It was wonderful. And so to be in this big giant room with these beautiful hardwood floors, these high ceilings and beams, how could I have nothing on the wall?
Yeah.
No, I mean, really. And that's how it started because, of course, I didn't have any money. I was a student. And then I, you know, as time went on, I found out that there was real art. You know?
Not just reproductions.
And I think... After my first book, I didn't have any real money, but I got royalties from that $7,500. Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm.
But, and when I was a matter of fact, when I was a student, I think, what's his name? I think I showed you that. God, what is his name?
You talking about a visual artist?
It was a piece of art that I bought with some of my grant money at Berkeley. When I was a student, that's when I bought my very first piece of, it was a serigraph.
Oh.
7 out of 50.
Oh, okay. That's a good number, by the way.
Yes, it is. Yeah. I didn't know it then.
Yeah.
I didn't know it then.
Right.
And I'm just, once again, blanking on his name, but I still have it. It's in my apartment.
It's not Hale Woodruff, no.
No. This guy's not black.
Oh, he's not a black guy.
No.
Okay.
I'll think of it before I walk out the door, probably.
Yeah, no problem.
But, but the bottom line is, and I call it Running Men. I don't even know if it has a name. And years ago, I paid 90. I used some of my student grant money.
Yeah.
And at Zellerbach at Berkeley on campus, they were having like an art show. And I was like, oh, okay. And I went up there and they had all these serigraphs and stuff. And I saw this one piece and I said, how much is that? $93. And I bought it. And let me tell you,
excellent.
It's worth a bundle now.
Oh, yeah. See, that's the beauty of it. Sometimes that happens. You
and people have offered to buy it. And I said,
no way.
Right? No. And I will never sell it. I don't care how much it's worth. I will never. And I told it, it's in my will. I told my son, if you ever sell this, I will come back and beat your ass. You don't sell this.
Don't sell it.
You don't sell this.
Strict orders.
You don't sell it. And he appreciates it.
Yeah.
But $93. And then I had this woman, and when I ended up teaching at the University of Wyoming for a year.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to get it reframed.
Yeah.
She said, what is that guy's name? She said, oh, she offered me $6,000 for it.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
Even back then,
yeah.
I didn't know how art appreciates.
Yeah.
And I said, $6,000? I said, I just came in here for a new frame.
Right. She's offering you $6,000.
And
that
she
must have
said,
been.
And I said, no. She said, $8,000.
Oh, my goodness.
I'll never forget it.
Oh, my goodness.
And I said, it's not for sale. And I know it, Lord knows. I mean, I got $25,000 for the semester to teach at the University of Wyoming,
uh-huh.
which was a lot of money back then,
yeah,
85
sure.
or whatever it was.
Right.
And but I said, you know what? I bought this because I liked it.
Which to me is the best reason to buy art of any.
Yeah, but the bottom line is, what would make you think I'd want to sell it?
Yeah. Well, she was testing you out for sure.
Yeah, but I mean, I found it a little insulting. Especially when she jacked up the price. And we're in Laramie, Wyoming, in Nowheresville.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
And she was really surprised that I had this thing. And even though it was a serigraph, she knew it was a low number, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. I didn't even realize it was a low number.
Yeah.
I did not.
Right.
But, and that's why, you know, 25, 30 years later, I still have it.
You still have it.
And I will not sell it.
Yeah, because you're still connected to the piece. Right?
Well, it's like, it's part of my evolution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but art to me is, some people see it as decoration. I don't see it as decoration.
Right.
I think it makes a statement about what you care about, what your vision is, what you think you see, what you don't see,
mm-hmm.
and it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And it adds energy, and it's just, I mean, I'm going to start crying in a minute here. I am not kidding you, because like every time I walk into my place, and you've been in there.
Yeah.
And I've had people offer, you know.
For that piece or for other pieces?
That one, but no, but my Sam Gillian, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
That, it's like, is this for sale? And I said, this is not an art gallery. Right. I live here.
Right.
I live
right.
here.
That must feel a little weird.
People, you know, but, you know, and I lived in a 6,500 square foot house. And I had, you know, Margaret Porter troupe.
Yes.
Yes, she came with a friend of hers, and they hung my artwork. And, I mean, I knew what I liked, but they knew how to hang it, and I didn't.
Right.
They was there for 3 or 4 days, and let me tell you, and my house, that house was in Architectural Digest. Hmm.
This is the place up in Northern California, right?
Or yep, that's a house I built. Yep. But the bottom line is I built it. When I was... Dealing with the architect, I said, you know what? Art's going to be in this house.
So that went into the whole design?
Yes, of course. I said, I don't want a whole bunch of bullshit, you know, curves and all this. I want my house to feel like an open air art gallery. And it did. Oh. It did. Even the skylights, it's like, you know, they had a certain kind of thing so they wouldn't screw up the art and all this.
All right.
And little kids would come over and say, why you got all this stuff on the wall? You know? And then they'd be sitting there staring at it. I think my dog even looked at the artwork, you know?
Yeah.
But it's like it's the best feeling in the world.
That sounds really wonderful.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, when you walk, even like my apartment now, it's right. like, you know, when people come in, they go like this. And it's not like I mean, the bottom line is I really don't know how people live without art. I really don't. I do not. And it doesn't even have to be real art. You know what I mean?
No, it's just something that
you
connects with you, right?
Yeah. But the bottom line is that I also wanted to be able to support African-American and African artists. And so most of the art I have is by Africans and African-Americans.
Well, you said something earlier. This is really interesting because, you know, I've been at this for a long time. And one of the biggest challenges for me as an art dealer was just to kind of get collectors in many cases. Now it's different. It's improving greatly. But back in the late 80s, when I started the gallery, you know, African-American art really wasn't, didn't have the prestige that it is gaining now. But in fact, it almost had the opposite reaction. It's like, oh my God, run away from that. You don't want that. So, and you had mentioned you hadn't even heard of, and I'm not surprised. I mean, a lot of folks hadn't heard of a lot of these artists. You just mentioned Sam Gilliam, for instance, and some of the older ones that are no longer with us, like Henry Tanner and so forth. Can you remember when you first became aware of African-American artists and how that happened?
I'm trying to think how. I've always had friends, you know, Margaret Porter Troop.
Who we should say had a gallery near San Diego.
Yes.
For a long time.
Yes.
Porter Troop Gallery.
Yes. And Ken Killaba.
Yep, which is still
Lower
working.
East Side. Yes,
New York.
Thank goodness. And, you know, my uncle worked at the Detroit Museum of Art.
Oh, okay.
Back in the day. Mm-hmm. But back then, I didn't know it. I didn't put two and two together. But the thing is that when I started realizing that how many black painters that we had, you know, from sculptures, you know, and what their medium, you know, with, you know, just watercolor and, you know, there were so many of them that I was just overwhelmed. And I had friends who also collected. I mean, because as we got older and then, you know, like as Margaret, because I've known Margaret and Quincy for years.
Mm-hmm.
And then when she opened her gallery in San Diego and she took a lot of my money. Oh, my God. She's the same one who helped me hang it.
Right.
But I just say here.
Yeah.
Take it. And I really didn't care because I had that Waiting to Exhale. I had a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And all I knew was that I wanted where I lived to breathe. I wanted beauty to just be everywhere. And it was done with taste. You know, I mean, I didn't overdo it. That's why I got Margaret. But I already knew that. But the way the light was, it's like, it was just important that I be surrounded by beauty. And all different forms of it,
yeah.
And shades of it. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It took a few days to actually hang this. And I mean,
I can imagine. It's not an easy thing to. It's more than just banging a hook in the wall and then draping the wire.
But not only that, but you know, I mean, I had a hallway.
Yeah.
That when I would walk in the front door, I mean, I had that Barber Chaser bolt.
Yeah.
750 pounds steel.
Yeah.
And rope. And my cat used to sleep in it at the bottom of it. But I mean, he was like Dilbert. That was his spot.
Well, the cat even appreciated the
work. Yeah. But the thing is that When it was like magic when I would come in home. And I lived on a cul-de-sac. And, you know, a lot of times when I travel, you know, the drivers, they turn on the cul-de-sac. And the house was white and big and not cokey. Right. It was more contemporary. And so, and they would always be, they said, this is where you live? And then when they bring the bags in, you know, they're like, they just look like this. And the lighting, I had the right kind of lighting, right? And they would just look. Because a lot of people don't see art. you know?
No, you're right. Even going to, there's studies about that in museums. A lot of times people go to museums, they spend less than 2 seconds with
it. And the way my art, the way it was hung, it wasn't ostentatious. It wasn't trying to like, oh, everybody look at what I bought. Mm-hmm. That wasn't it. Right. When you walked into that house, when I walked into that house, I was in love. You know, and I would just, sometimes I'd even say, thank you. Just because I felt, I don't know, there was a, it's just a certain amount of what it evoked. It's just, I felt like, you know, I'm glad I live here. I'm glad you guys are here. You are here to welcome me. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I could turn this way and there's beauty. This way there's a different kind of emotion that's evoked. And I'm telling you, I got chill bumps right now. It's like a lot of people have no idea what the value of art is.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, though, and the way you're describing it, because a lot of times, you know, we only use our eyes, but I tell folks when you see a piece, it's not just seeing it, it's feeling it.
Oh, well, that's right? Why I buy it. That's why, I mean, and I've spent a lot of money, and I'm so glad I have never bought a piece of art that I wish I hadn't bought. Mm-hmm. Never, ever, ever, ever. That's why I still have my very first piece.
Yeah.
You know, I knew then what moved me.
Right.
I knew what I thought I was seeing, and it didn't even matter. And if everybody has their own interpretation of what they see,
yeah,
and what's evoked, what you feel from it,
yeah,
like this one right here. I mean,
yeah,
that's Jamaica.
That's Phoebe Beasley. Yeah, made in Jamaica.
You know, and I'm looking at this child right here, and yeah, I'm like, you know what? She coming from the market.
Yeah. That's
from the market.
That's very astute.
Her hair is not combed.
Right.
She probably hasn't bathed.
Right, exactly.
In Jamaica, I mean, you know, yeah, and people behind her with babies, and nobody has any money.
No, that's right. These are just ordinary folks.
They don't have any money. And she looks sad. She looks desperate, like, I got to hurry up and get home.
Yeah.
You don't know why.
Right.
That's what I love about art. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's what I see.
Yeah.
I don't know that's what anybody else would see. And it doesn't matter.
No, that's the beauty of it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you communicate with it in a way. If you open yourself up to it, that's a beautiful thing about it.
Yeah.
Now, I never saw your home in Northern California, but I did see your place in outside of L.A. in Pasadena. And I have to say, I mean, that same feeling you're describing, I got when I was in your place. I mean, look around. There's wonderful pieces hanging there that are.
And I hung those myself this time.
Yeah.
Well,
you did a fabulous job.
I had somebody hang them for, but I chose where.
You chose
to put
where
them.
They went. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the big decision, is where to put them.
But also, you know how much stuff I have in storage.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, quite a bit.
Because I mean, you know, some people like they want to overdo it just because you have it. You know. No. And plus, what I love for a piece to stand by itself.
Yeah.
I want to say, you know, this is your wall. This is your home.
Yes.
You know, and I mean, every time I walk in my door, there's that one piece. And it's like, I think unless I was starving to death, I would never sell it. I would never sell it. And there's certain pieces that, I mean, over the years, I've gotten maybe a little bored with, because I realize that I'm never living in a big dying house again.
Right.
And I can't hang all this work.
Right.
I cannot.
Yeah.
And so I had to really decide, what could I live without?
Must have been a tough decision, though.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah. But the other thing is this, I know what I would never sell. You know,
mm-hmm.
I know what I would never sell. And because there's certain pieces, I know where I lived when I bought it.
Mm-hmm.
I know what I was going through when I bought it.
That's an interesting perspective, because it ties you back to a period of time early in your
life.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, and I have one big piece. Matter of fact, not Mary Lovelace, but what's his name?
Oliver Jackson, maybe? Or?
No, well, Oliver Jackson. I had him over above my bed, which was not smart. But
and the reason you say that, I'm guessing, is because
one of them was a little, you know,
it's earthquake country, could fall on you, that kind of thing.
No, I think the one piece, I liked it then, but when I started looking, because it was watercolor, it's still beautiful.
Yeah.
Still beautiful. But I did think, you know, what if it fell and hit me in the fucking head?
Well, that's always a consideration, though. But, it really is.
But it was beautiful in this room. And, you know, this guy I was married to, he did not get it. He did not get any of it. What is that? And I said, you know what? Don't even worry about it. You know, he was much younger than I was, so he didn't get a lot of stuff. But the bottom line is that, you know, a lot of people, you know, I've had people to come to my house and say, how much did that thing cost? And I just lie, or else I'll just say it's none of your business.
Well, that's the thing.
How much is that outfit that you're wearing? How much did you pay for those shoes?
Right, and then you have to ask, what does it matter?
I mean, I said, you know what? I don't know how people live without beauty.
Yeah,
I really don't. I do not.
I agree.
And I have been to people's homes where there's nothing on the wall, and it's a coldness.
I was going to say, that sounds depressing.
It is. It is. It is. But you'd be surprised. There are people that, and I, you know, even my son, I think he has a poster of Jimi Hendrix, but that's still, he's got something on the wall. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
But he gets it, and he had art in his room. He does get it, you know, but he doesn't have any money, and he's not getting any of mine to buy art. You know, I put gas in that car.
That's as far as it goes.
Yeah. But he understands it. And also, when he was younger, he used to love it when he would bring his friends over. Because they would say, Solomon, who bought all this stuff? You know, and then he knew who the painters were. Sometimes he knew the story behind it. He kind of got off on it, too.
Yeah.
You know, and he said, and my mom bought this one. You know, and sometimes he didn't even know I was listening, and I would be so proud.
I didn't even know he cared. That's the thing. I just want to ask you, because I had a similar experience with my own daughter. I realized that she was listening more carefully than I thought she was. Yeah. Did you have that experience?
Yeah, but I mean, I didn't hear it. I mean, it didn't happen all the time, but the bottom line is that he was in high school.
Yeah.
And Pete and his friends, you know, they're like these jocks and all this, and they would say, hey, man. Where'd y'all get all this art and stuff? And Solomon said, he would tell them, I can't remember verbatim, but he would just say, you know, they didn't understand, you know, how did it get up there on the wall, up there so high and all this, and like, what is that? And he said, you know, that's called an abstract. And they were like, you know, and he'd say, you know, the stuff that happens with art, there's feelings in it. And sometimes some of the stuff he said didn't make any sense.
Right.
But the bottom line is
he was trying to articulate.
But he knew, and he had art in his room, you know, and we went to the 2000 Olympics in France. Not the Olympics, whatever it was. It's the one they have in between the Olympics. And I bought this black girl who was a runner. And in Paris, I mean, I didn't realize how seriously they took track and field.
Oh, really?
Oh, my goodness. Hmm. Yes, Lord. And the whole city was full of all these athletes. And they, in some cases, almost as probably as tall as this building.
Oh, wow.
Of all these athletes, and it was beautiful all over Paris.
Oh, wow.
And I got a poster of it, and I had it. It was a real poster, but I didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
And I had it framed and all that, and I had it put in my son's room. And they're doing like, but it was the...
So they were in motion, the athletes?
Yes, yes. But the thing is, to see it in Paris all over.
It must have been spectacular.
Oh, my God. They were like almost as tall as some of them, almost as tall as the building. You don't see that in the United States.
Right.
You don't see it.
Yeah.
See it at, you know, LAX.
Right. Right.
But you don't see it. So, but no, I don't know. I don't. There's some pieces that I would never. I mean, I'll put them in my will. They might be in there now. Who knows? But I told my son, you know, this. I'm going to tell you right now, I got certain things earmarked. If you sell these, I will come back and kick your ass. Okay?
Right.
Give them to my grandkids if I ever have any, which I don't care if I do. But, you know, you don't.
Don't.
You got to know what to treasure. And art to me, I do not regret a single dollar I've ever spent on a piece of art. Not. I do not. I don't know. I do not. Nice. I do not. And I've spent a lot of money.
Right, because you have an enormous collection.
Well, you know, there are people that, and I love it when I go to someone's house. And because it tells me everything about them. You know, mm-hmm. I can tell what they care about. I can almost try to imagine what they saw in that.
Mm-hmm.
That too tells me about them, you know. And a lot of my friends, not all of them, but a lot of them are collectors. Mm-hmm. And all I know is that there's a reason why, when I was younger, that this happened to me, you know, that I was affected. And to me, it does a lot similar to what you get in a book.
Yeah.
There's something that, and everybody, I think this is it. Everybody, you can have 15 people in a room, not necessarily a gallery or whatever,
yeah,
that all look at the same piece, and everybody sees it differently.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And that's what I love it. And I wish I could paint.
Well, you do, actually. You don't paint, but you do. Let's see. You made those beautiful lampshades I saw.
Oh, yeah, that stuff. That's it. Yeah. But the thing is this, I don't mean it like that. I mean, I don't really wish I could. I mean, I haven't really painted. No. Uh-uh.
And you wouldn't try?
I like looking at what other people do and how they see the world, or saw the world, or see people, or, you know, like that tree. I mean, and I get like art news and all these things in my inbox on email.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And let me tell you, sometimes I get stuff from my editor.
Regarding art?
No, just stuff from my publisher and stuff. And if I see art news, I'll skip over what they have to say and look at art news first. And then I go, you know?
Yeah.
And so I mean, there's about four or five of these publications. That's the one that pops, you know, and I just,
Well, that's so heartening, though. It's really heartening to hear that you have that deep appreciation for.
But I have to look at a piece of art and literally cry because it's so beautiful and it does something inside of me.
Yeah.
And it's not like I'm trying to be corny or sentimental or maudlin or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but it's like, I just think,
yeah.
Who? How? What did they see? What were they feeling when they did it? When they painted it?
Yeah.
When they put that little over there? I mean, look at the watermelon there. I mean, and the person's back to you.
Yeah. Now you're talking about the bees.
Yeah.
The bees,
I mean, that's just one picture.
Yeah.
That's just one painting. And this
she
woman,
captures a lot.
This woman, with this food going home, you know she's going to cook.
Oh yeah.
But look at her eyes.
Yeah.
You're She's right. scared. She's worried about something.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with food.
Right.
You know, I mean, all of that. I just, you know, and not only that, but this is literature on a canvas.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they're telling a story. That's a movie there.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I don't know how people live without it. I really don't.
I don't either. I have to say.
Even if you got to buy something phony. I mean, you know, a little picture, cut it out, put some glue on the back of it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. No, you can get stuff. For example, you can find an artist that you never heard of before sometimes, and their prices aren't too high. And that's one way to get in, as long as you connect with the piece. But like you said, reproductions, anything.
That's how I got some of mine early on.
Yeah.
Early on.
Yeah.
You know, especially I lived in Berkeley too. They'd have art shows and stuff.
Right.
And
you have these artists that are struggling and they're just trying to get known, and they're out there doing their thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, Terry, I want to thank you so much. It looks like we've come to the end of our talk, and thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For sharing your perspective. And I want to invite everybody out there to be sure to subscribe to Eric's Perspective. Thank you for joining us, and we look forward to the next time. Thank you very much.